be. As they pulled up, a man came hurtling out of the open door, another man on top of him. They fell and rolled on the sidewalk, and the man on top, holding the other's hair in both hands, banged his head up and down on the cement, making a sickening noise. No one at the bar was paying any attention. The sheriff got out of the car and grabbed the man on top by the shoulder. "Cut it out," he said. "Get up there." The man straightened up and looked at the sheriff. "For Christ's sake, can't you mind your own business?" The other man, blood in his hair, blood oozing from one ear and more of it trickling down his freckled face, squared off at the sheriff. "Leave my buddy alone," he said thickly. "What's the matter? Don't you think I can take it?" "You can take it, Joey," the man who had been hammering him said. "Listen," to the sheriff, "could you let me take a buck?" "No," said the sheriff. "Go to hell, then," he turned to Richard Gordon. "What about it, pal?"
"I'll buy you a drink," said Gordon.
"Come on," said the vet and took hold of Gordon's arm.
"I'll be by later," the sheriff said.
"Good. I'll be waiting for you."
As they edged in toward the end of the bar, the red-headed, freckle-faced man with the bloody ear and face gripped Gordon by the arm.
"My old buddy," he said.
"He's all right," the other vet said. "He can take it."
"I can take it, see?" the bloody-faced one said. "That's where I got it on them."
"But you can't hand it out," someone said. "Cut out the shoving."
"Let us in," the bloody-faced one said.
"Let in me and my old buddy,"
he whispered into Richard Gordon's ear. "I don't have to hand it out. I can take it, see?"
"Listen,"
the other vet said as they finally reached the beer-wet bar.
"You ought to have seen him at noon at the commissary at Camp 5. I had him down and I was hitting him on the head with a bottle, just like playing on a drum. I bet I hit him 50 times.
"More,"
said the bloody-faced one.
"It didn't make no impression on him."
"I can take it,"
said the other. He whispered in Richard Gordon's ear.
"It's a secret."
Richard Gordon handed over 2 of the 3 beers the white-jacketed, big-bellied nigger bartender drew and pushed toward him.
"What's a secret?" he asked.
"Me,"
said the bloody-faced one.
"My secret."
"He's got a secret," the other vet said.
"He isn't lying."
"Wanna hear it?"
the bloody-faced one said in Richard Gordon's ear. Gordon nodded.
"It don't hurt."
The other nodded.
"Tell him the worst of it."
The red-headed one put his bloody lips almost to Gordon's ear.
"Sometimes it feels good,"
he said.
"How do you feel about that?"
At Gordon's elbow was a tall, thin man with a scar that ran from one corner of his eye down over his chin. He looked down at the red-headed one and grinned.
"First it was an art," he said. "Then it became a pleasure. If things made me sick, you'd make me sick, Red."
"You make sick easy," the first vet said. "What outfit were you in?"
"It wouldn't mean anything to you, punch drunk," the tall man said.
"Have a drink?" Richard Gordon asked the tall man.
"Thanks," the other said. "I'm drinking."
"Don't forget us,"
said one of the 2 men Gordon had come in with.
3 more beers, said Richard Gordon. And the Negro drew them and pushed them over. There was not elbow room to lift them in the crowd, and Gordon was pressed against the tall man.
"You off a ship?" asked the tall man.
"No, staying here. You down from the Keys?"
"We came in tonight from Tortugas," the tall man said. "We raised enough hell so they couldn't keep us there."
"He's a red," the first vet said.
"So would you be if you had any brains," the tall man said. "They sent a bunch of us there to get rid of us, but we raised too much hell for them." He grinned at Richard Gordon.
"Nail that guy," somebody yelled, and Richard Gordon saw a fist hit a face that showed close to him.
The man who was hit was pulled away from the bar by 2 others. In the clear, 1 man hit him again hard in the face, and the other hit him in the body. He went down on the cement floor and covered his head with his arms, and one of the men kicked him in the small of the back. All this time he had not made a sound. One of the men jerked him to his feet and pushed him up against the wall.
"Cool the son of a bitch," he said,
and as the man sprawled white-faced against the wall, the second man set himself, knees slightly bent, and then swung up at him with a right fist that came from down near the cement floor and landed on the side of the white-faced man's jaw. He fell forward on his knees and then rolled slowly over his head in a little pool of blood. The 2 men left him there and came back to the bar.
"Boy, you can hit," said one. "That son of a bitch comes into town and puts all his pay in the postal savings and then hangs around here picking up drinks off the bar.
the other said. That's the second time I cooled him.
You cooled him this time?
When I hit him just then, I felt his jaw go just like a bag of marbles, the other said happily.
The man lay against the wall and nobody paid any attention to him.
Listen, if you landed on me like that, it wouldn't make no impression,
the red-headed vet said.
Shut up, Slappy, said the cooler. You've got the old row.
No, I haven't.
You punchies make me sick, the cooler said.
Why should I bust my hands on you?
That's just what you do, bust your hands,
the red-headed one said.
Listen, pal,
to Richard Gordon,
how's to have another?
Aren't they fine boys, said the tall man. War is a purifying and ennobling force. The question is whether only people like ourselves here are fitted to be soldiers, or whether the different services have formed us.
I don't know, said Richard Gordon.
I would like to bet you that not 3 men in this room were drafted, the tall man said. These are the elite, the very top cream of the scum, what Wellington won at Waterloo with. Well, Mr. Hoover ran us out of Anacostia Flats, and Mr. Roosevelt has shipped us down here to get rid of us. They've run the camp in a way to invite an epidemic, but the poor bastards won't die. They shipped a few of us to Tortugas, but that's healthy now. Besides, we wouldn't stand for it, so they've brought us back. What's the next move? They've got to get rid of us. You can see that, can't you?
Why? Because we are the desperate ones, the man said. The ones with nothing to lose. We are the completely brutalized ones. We're worse than the stuff the original Spartacus worked with. But it's tough to try to do anything with, because we have been beaten so far that the only solace is booze, and the only pride is in being able to take it. But we're not all like that.
There are some of us that are going to hand it out.
Are there many communists in the camp?
Only about 40, the tall man said, out of 2,000. It takes discipline and abnegation to be a communist. A rummy can't be a communist.
Don't listen to him, the red-headed vet said. He's just a goddamn radical.
Listen, the other vet who was drinking beer with Richard Gordon said, let me tell you about in the Navy. Let me tell you, you goddamn radical.
Don't listen to him, the red-headed one said. When the fleet's in New York and you go ashore there in the evening up under Riverside Drive, there's old guys with long beards come down, and you can piss in their beards for a dollar. What do you think about that?
I'll buy you a drink, said the tall man, and you forget that one. I don't like to hear that one.
I don't forget anything, the red-headed one said. What's the matter with you, pal?
Is that true about the beards? Richard Gordon asked. He felt a little sick.
I swear to God and my mother, the red-headed one said. Hell, that ain't nothing.
Up the bar, a vet was arguing with Freddy about the payment of a drink. That's what you had, said Freddy.
Richard Gordon watched the vet's face. He was very drunk. His eyes were bloodshot, and he was looking for trouble.
You're a goddamn liar, he said to Freddy.
85 cents, Freddy said to him.
Watch this, said the red-headed vet. Freddy spread his hands on the bar. He was watching the vet.
You're a goddamn liar,
said the vet, and picked up a beer glass to throw it. As his hand closed on it, Freddy's right hand swung in a half-circle over the bar and cracked a big salt cellar covered with a bar towel alongside the vet's head.
Was it neat? Said the red-headed vet. Was it pretty?
You ought to see him tap them with that sawed-off billiard cue, the other said.
Two vets standing next to where the salt cellar man had slipped down looked at Freddy angrily.
What's the idea of cooling him?
Take it easy, said Freddy.
This one is on the house. Hey, Wallace, he said, put that fellow over against the wall.
Was it pretty? The red-headed vet asked Richard Gordon. Wasn't that sweet?
A heavy-set young fellow had dragged the salt-cellared man out through the crowd. He pulled him to his feet, and the man looked at him vacantly.
Run along, he said to him. Get yourself some air.
Over against the wall, the man who had been cooled sat with his head in his hands. The heavy-set young man went over to him.
You run along, too, he said to him. You just get in trouble here.
My jaw's broken,
the cooled one said thickly. Blood was running out of his mouth and down over his chin.
You're lucky you aren't killed, that wallop he hit you, the thick-set young man said. You run along now.
My jaw's broke,
the other said dully.
They broke my jaw.
You better run along, the young man said. You just get in trouble here.
He helped the jaw-broken man to his feet, and he staggered unsteadily out to the street.
I've seen a dozen laying against the wall over there on a big night,
the red-headed vet said.
One morning I seen that big boogie there mopping it up with a bucket. Didn't I see you mop it up with a bucket?
He asked the big Negro bartender.
Yes, sir, said the bartender. Plenty of times. Yes, sir, but you never seen me fight nobody.
Didn't I tell you? Said the red-headed vet. With a bucket.
This looks like a big night coming on, the other vet said.
What do you say, pal?
To Richard Gordon.
Okay, we have another one?
Richard Gordon could feel himself getting drunk. His face reflected in the mirror behind the bar was beginning to look strange to him. What's your name? He asked the tall communist.
Jax, the tall man said. Nelson Jax.
Where were you before you came here?
Oh, around, the man said. Mexico, Cuba, South America, and around.
I envy you, said Richard Gordon.
Why envy me? Why don't you get to work?
I've written 3 books, Richard Gordon said. I'm writing one now about Gastonia.
Good, said the tall man. That's fine. What did you say your name was?
Richard Gordon.
Oh, said the tall man.
What do you mean, oh?
Nothing, said the tall man.
Did you ever read the books? Richard Gordon asked.
Yes.
Didn't you like them?
No, said the tall man.
Why?
I don't like to say.
Go ahead.
I thought they were shit, the tall man said and turned away.
I guess this is my night, said Richard Gordon. This is my big night. What did you say you'd have? He asked the red-headed vet.
I've got $2 left.
One beer, said the red-headed man. Listen, you're my pal. I think your books are fine. To hell with that radical bastard.
You haven't got a book with you? Asked the other vet.
Pal, I'd like to read one. Did you ever write for Western Stories or War Aces? I could read that War Aces every day.
Who is that tall bird? Asked Richard Gordon.
I tell you, he's just a radical bastard, said the second vet. The camp's full of them. We'd run them out, but I tell you, half the time most of the guys in camp can't remember.
Can't remember what?
Asked the red-headed one.
Can't remember anything, said the other.
You see me?
Asked the red-headed one.
Yes, said Richard Gordon.
Would you guess I got the finest little wife in the world?
Why not?
Well, I have, said the red-headed one. And that girl is nuts about me. She's like a slave. Give me another cup of coffee, I say to her. Okay, Pop, she says. And I get it. Anything else the same way. She's carried away with me. If I got a whim, it's her law.
Only where is she? Asked the other vet.
That's it, said the red-headed one. That's it, pal. Where is she?
He don't know where she is, the second vet said.
Not only that, said the red-headed one. I don't know where I saw her last.
He don't even know what country she's in.
But listen, buddy, said the red-headed one. Wherever she is, that little girl is faithful.
That's God's truth, said the other vet. You can stake your life on that.
Sometimes, said the red-headed one, I think that she is maybe Ginger Rogers, and that she has gone into the moving pictures.
Why not? Said the other.
Then again, I just see her waiting there quietly where I live.
Keep the home fires burning, said the other.
That's it, said the red-headed one. She's the finest little woman in the world.
Listen, said the other. My old mother is okay, too.
That's right.
She's dead, said the second vet. Let's not talk about her.
Aren't you married, pal?
The red-headed vet asked Richard Gordon.
Sure, he said. Down the bar about 4 men away, he could see the red face, the blue eyes, and sandy beard-dewed mustache of Professor MacWalsey. Professor MacWalsey was looking straight ahead of him, and as Richard Gordon watched, he finished his glass of beer and, raising his lower lip, removed the foam from his mustache. Richard Gordon noticed how bright blue his eyes were. As Richard Gordon watched him, he felt a sick feeling in his chest, and he knew for the first time how a man feels when he looks at the man his wife is leaving him for.
"What's the matter, pal?"
asked the red-headed vet.
"Nothing."
You don't feel good. I can tell you feel bad.
No, said Richard Gordon.
You look like you've seen a ghost.
You see that fellow down there with a mustache? Asked Richard Gordon.
Him?
Yes. What about him? Asked the second vet. Nothing, said Richard Gordon.
God damn it.
Nothing. Is he a bother to you? We can cool him. The three of us can jump him and you can put the boots to him. No, said Richard Gordon. It wouldn't do any good.
We'll get him when he goes outside, the red-headed vet said. I don't like the look of him. The son of a bitch looks like a scab to me.
I hate him, said Richard Gordon. He's ruined my life. We'll give him the works, said the second vet, the yellow rat. Listen, Red, get a hold of a couple of bottles. We'll beat him to death. Listen, when did he do it, pal? Okay, we have another one?
We've got $1.70, Richard Gordon said.
Maybe we better get a pint, then, the red-headed vet said. My teeth are floating now.
No, said the other. This beer is good for you. This is draft beer. Stick with the beer. Let's go and beat this guy up and come back, drink some more beer.
No, leave him alone.
No, pal, not us. You said that rat ruined your wife.
My life, not my wife.
Geez, pardon me, I'm sorry, pal.
He defaulted and ruined the bank, the other vet said. I'll bet there's a reward for him. By God, I seen a picture of him at the post office today.
What were you doing at the post office? Asked the other suspiciously.
Can't I get a letter?
What's the matter with getting letters at camp?
Do you think I went to the postal savings?
What were you doing in the post office?
I just stopped by.
Take that, said his pal, and swung on him as well as he could in the crowd.
There goes those two cellmates, said somebody.
Holding and punching, kneeing and butting, the two were pushed out of the door.
Let 'em fight on the sidewalk, the wide-shouldered young man said. Those bastards fight 3 or 4 times a night.
They're a couple of punchies, another vet said. Red could fight once, but he's got the old row.
They've both got it.
Red got it fighting a fellow in the ring, a short, chunky vet said. This fellow had the old row, and he was all broke out on the shoulders and back. Every time they'd go into a clinch, he'd rub his shoulder under Red's nose or across his puss. Oh, nuts, what did he put his face there for?
That was the way Red carried his head when he was in close, down like this, and this fellow was just roughing him.
Oh, nuts, that story is all bull. Nobody ever got the old row from anybody in a fight.
That's what you think. Listen, Red was as clean a living kid as you ever saw.
I knew him. He was in my outfit. He was a good little fighter, too. I mean good. He was married, too, to a nice girl. I mean nice. And this Benny Sampson gave him that old row just as sure as I'm standing here.
Then sit down, said another vet. How did Poochie get it?
He got it in Shanghai.
Where did you get yours?
I ain't got it.
Where did Suds get it?
Off a girl in Brest, coming home.
That's all you guys ever talk about, the old row. What difference does the old row make?
None, the way we are now, one vet said. You're just as happy with it.
Poochie's happier. He don't know where he is.
What's the old row? Professor McWalsey asked the man next to him at the bar. The man told him. I wonder what the derivation is, Professor McWalsey said.
I don't know, said the man. I've always heard it called the old row since my first enlistment. Some call it row, but usually they call it the old row.
I'd like to know, said Professor McWalsey. Most of those terms are old English words.
Why do they call it the old row?
The vet next to Professor McWalsey asked another.
I don't know.
Nobody seemed to know, but all enjoyed the atmosphere of serious philological discussion. Richard Gordon was next to Professor McWalsey at the bar now. When Red and Poochie had started fighting, he had been pushed down there, and he had not resisted the move. Hello, Professor McWalsey said to him. Do you want a drink?
Not with you, said Richard Gordon.
I suppose you're right, said Professor McWalsey. Did you ever see anything like this?
No, said Richard Gordon.
It's very strange, said Professor McWalsey. They're amazing. I always come here nights.
Don't you ever get in trouble?
No, why should I?
Drunken fights.
I never seem to have any trouble.
A couple of friends of mine wanted to beat you up a couple of minutes ago.
Yes.
I wish I would have let them.
I don't think it would make much difference, said Professor McWalsey in the odd way of speaking he had. If I annoy you by being here, I can go.
No, said Richard Gordon. I sort of like to be near you.
Yes, said Professor McWalsey.
Have you ever been married?
Asked Richard Gordon.
Yes.
What happened? My wife died during the influenza epidemic in 1918.
Why do you want to marry again now?
I think I'd be better at it now. I think perhaps I'd be a better husband now.
So you picked my wife?
Yes, said Professor McWalsey.
Damn you, said Richard Gordon, and hit him in the face.
Someone grabbed his arm. He jerked it loose and someone hit him crashingly behind the ear. He could see Professor McWalsey before him, still at the bar, his face red, blinking his eyes. He was reaching for another beer to replace the one Gordon had spilled, and Richard Gordon drew back his arm to hit him again. As he did so, something exploded again behind his ear, and all the lights flared up, wheeled round, and then went out. Then he was standing in the doorway of Freddy's place. His head was ringing and the crowded room was unsteady and wheeling slightly and he felt sick to his stomach. He could see the crowd looking at him. The big-shouldered young man was standing by him.
Listen, he was saying, you don't want to start any trouble in here. There's enough fights in here with those rummies.
Who hit me? Asked Richard Gordon.
I hit you, said the wide young man. That fellow's a regular customer here. You want to take it easy. You don't want to go to fight in here.
Standing unsteadily, Richard Gordon saw Professor McWalsey coming toward him away from the crowd at the bar.
I'm sorry, he said. I didn't want anybody to slug you. I don't blame you for feeling the way you do.
God damn you, said Richard Gordon and started toward him. It was the last thing he remembered doing, for the wide young man set himself, dropped his shoulders slightly, and clipped him again, and he went down, this time on the cement floor on his face.
The wide young man turned to Professor McWalsey.
That's all right, Doc, he said hospitably. He won't annoy you now. What's the matter with him, anyway?
I've got to take him home, said Professor McWalsey. Will he be all right?
Sure.
Help me to get him in a taxi, said Professor McWalsey.
They carried Richard Gordon out between them and, with the driver helping, put him in the old Model T taxi.
You're sure he'll be all right? Asked Professor McWalsey.
Just pull on his ears good when you want to bring him to. Put some water on him. Look out he don't want to fight when he comes to. Don't let him grab you, Doc.
No, said Professor McWalsey.
Richard Gordon's head lay back at an odd angle in the back of the taxi, and he made a heavy rasping noise when he breathed. Professor McWalsey put his arm under his head and held it so it did not bump against the seat.
Where are we going? Asked the taxi driver.
Out on the other end of town, said Professor McWalsey. Past the park, down the street from the place where they sell mullets.
That's the rocky road, the driver said.
Yes, said Professor McWalsey.
As they passed the first coffee shop up the street, Professor McWalsey told the driver to stop. He wanted to go in and get some cigarettes. He laid Richard Gordon's head down carefully on the seat and went into the coffee shop. When he came out to get back into the taxi, Richard Gordon was gone.
Where did he go?
He asked the driver.
That's him up the street, the driver said.
Catch up with him.
As the taxi pulled up even with him, Professor McWalsey got out and went up to Richard Gordon, who was lurching along the sidewalk.
Come on, Gordon, he said. We're going home. Richard Gordon looked at him.
We? He said, swaying.
I want you to go home in this taxi.
You go to hell.
I wish you'd come, Professor McWalsey said. I want you to get home safely.
Where's your gang? Said Richard Gordon.
What gang?
Your gang that beat me up.
That was the bouncer. I didn't know he was going to hit you.
You lie, said Richard Gordon.
He swung at the red-faced man in front of him and missed him. He slipped forward onto his knees and got up slowly. His knees were scraped raw from the sidewalk, but he did not know it.
Come on and fight, he said brokenly.
I don't fight, said Professor McWalsey. If you'll get into the taxi, I'll leave you.
Go to hell, said Richard Gordon and started down the street.
Leave him go, said the taxi driver. He's all right now.
Do you think he'll be all right?
Hell, the taxi driver said. He's perfect.
I'm worried about him, Professor McWalsey said.
You can't get him in without fighting him, the taxi driver said. Let him go. He's fine. Is he your brother?
In a way, said Professor McWalsey.
He watched Richard Gordon lurching down the street until he was out of sight in the shadow from the big trees whose branches dipped down to grow into the ground like roots. What he was thinking as he watched him was not pleasant. It is a mortal sin, he thought, a grave and deadly sin and a great cruelty. And while technically one's religion may permit the ultimate result, I cannot pardon myself. On the other hand, a surgeon cannot desist while operating for fear of hurting the patient. But why must all the operations in life be performed without an anesthetic? If I had been a better man, I would have let him beat me up. It would have been better for him, the poor stupid man, the poor homeless man. I ought to stay with him, but I know that is too much for him to bear. I am ashamed and disgusted with myself, and I hate what I have done. It all may turn out badly, too, but I must not think about that. I will now return to the anesthetic I have used for 17 years and will not need much longer, although it is probably a vice now for which I only invent excuses, though at least it is a vice for which I am suited. But I wish I could help that poor man whom I am wronging. Drive me back to Freddy's, he said.
Chapter 23 The Coast Guard cutter towing the Queen Conch was coming down the Hawk Channel between the reef and the quays. The cutter rolled in the cross chop the light north wind raised against the flood tide, but the white boat was towing easily and well.
She'll be all right if it doesn't breeze, the Coast Guard captain said. She tows pretty, too. That Robbie built nice boats.
Could you make out any of the guff he was talking?
He didn't make any sense, the mate said. He's way out of his head.
I guess he'll die all right, the captain said. Shot in the belly that way.
Do you suppose he killed those 4 Cubans?
You can't tell. I asked him, but he didn't know what I was saying.
Should we go talk to him again?
Let's have a look at him, the captain said.
Leaving the quartermaster at the wheel, running the beacons down the channel, they went behind the wheelhouse into the captain's cabin. Harry Morgan lay there on the iron pipe bunk. His eyes were closed, but he opened them when the captain touched his wide shoulder.
How you feeling, Harry? The captain asked him. Harry looked at him and did not speak.
Can we get you anything, boy? The captain asked him.
Harry Morgan looked at him.
He don't hear you, said the mate.
Harry, said the captain, do you want anything, boy?
He wet a towel in the water bottle on a gimbal by the bunk and moistened Harry Morgan's deeply cracked lips. They were dry and black-looking. Looking at him, Harry Morgan started speaking.
A man, he said.
Sure, said the captain. Go on.
A man, said Harry Morgan very slowly, ain't got no, hasn't got any, can't really, isn't any way out.
He stopped. There had been no expression on his face at all when he spoke.
Go on, Harry, said the captain. Tell us who did it. How did it happen, boy?
A man, said Harry, looking at him now with his narrow eyes on the wide, high-cheekboned face, trying now to tell him.
4 men, said the captain helpfully.
He moistened the lips again, squeezing the towel so a few drops went between them.
A man, corrected Harry, then stopped.
All right.
A man, the captain said.
A man, Harry said again very flatly. Very slowly, talking with his dry mouth. Now the way things are, the way that they go, no matter what, no.
The captain looked at the mate and shook his head.
Who did it, Harry? The mate asked.
Harry looked at him. Don't fool yourself, he said.
The captain and the mate both bent over him. Now it was coming. Like trying to pass cars on the top of hills. On that road in Cuba. On any road. Anywhere. Just like that. I mean, how things are. The way that they've been going. For a while, yes, sure, all right. Maybe with luck. A man. He stopped. The captain shook his head at the mate again. Harry Morgan looked at him flatly. The captain wet Harry's lips again. They made a bloody mark on the towel. A man, Harry Morgan said, looking at them both. One man alone ain't got. No man alone now. He stopped. No matter how, a man alone ain't got no bloody fucking chance. He shut his eyes. It had taken him a long time to get it out, and it had taken him all of his life to learn it. He lay there, his eyes open again. Come on, said the captain to the mate. You sure you don't want anything, Harry? Harry Morgan looked at him, but he did not answer. He had told them, but they had not heard. We'll be back, said the captain. Take it easy, boy. Harry Morgan watched them go out of the cabin. Forward in the wheelhouse, watching it get dark and the light of sombrero starting to sweep out at sea, the mate said, He gives you the willies out of his head like that. Poor fellow, said the captain. Well, we'll be in pretty soon now. We'll get him in soon after midnight, if we don't have to slow down for that tow. Think he'll live? No, said the captain. But you can't ever tell.
Chapter 24 There were many people in the dark street outside the iron gates that closed the entrance to the old submarine base now transformed into a yacht basin. The Cuban watchman had orders to let no one in, and the crowd were pressing against the fence to look through between the iron rods into the dark enclosure lit along the water by the lights of the yachts that lay moored at the finger piers. The crowd was as quiet as only a Key West crowd can be. The yachtsmen pushed and elbowed their way through to the gate and by the watchman. "Hey, you cannot come in," the watchman said. "What the hell? We're off a yacht." "Nobody's supposed to come in," the watchman said. "Get back." "Don't be stupid," said one of the yachtsmen and pushed him aside to go up the road toward the dock. Behind them was the crowd outside the gates, where the little watchman stood uncomfortable and anxious in his cap, his long mustache, and his disheveled authority. Wishing he had a key to lock the big gate, and, as they strode hardily up the sloping road, they saw ahead, then past, a group of men waiting at the Coast Guard pier. They paid no attention to them, but walked along the dock past the piers where the other yachts lay, to Pier Number 5, and out on the pier to where the gangplank reached in the glare of a floodlight, from rough wooden pier to the teak deck of the new Exuma 2. In the main cabin, they sat in big leather chairs beside a long table on which magazines were spread, and one of them rang for the steward. "Scotch and soda," he said. "You, Henry?" "Yes," said Henry Carpenter. "What was the matter with that silly ass at the gate?" "I've no idea," said Henry Carpenter. The steward in his white jacket brought the two glasses. "Play those discs I put out after dinner," the yachtsman, whose name was Wallace Johnston, said. "I'm afraid I put them away, sir," the steward said. "Damn you," said Wallace Johnston. "Play that new Bach album, then." "Very good, sir," said the steward. He went over to the record cabinet and took out an album and moved with it to the phonograph. He began playing the Saraband. "Did you see Tommy Bradley today?" asked Henry Carpenter. "I saw him as the plane came in." "I can't bear him," said Wallace. "Neither him nor that whore of a wife of his." "I like Helene," said Henry Carpenter. "She has such a good time." "Did you ever try it?" "Of course, it's marvelous." "I can't stick her at any price," said Wallace Johnston. "Why in God's name does she live down here?" "They have a lovely place." "It is a nice, clean little yacht basin," said Wallace Johnston. "Is it true Tommy Bradley's impotent?"
I shouldn't think so. You hear that about everyone.
He's simply broad-minded.
Broad-minded is excellent. She's certainly a broad, if there ever was one.
She's a remarkably nice woman, said Henry Carpenter. You'd like her, Wally.
I would not, said Wallace.
She represents everything I hate in a woman, and Tommy Bradley epitomizes everything I hate in a man.
You feel awfully strongly tonight.
You never feel strongly because you have no consistency, Wallace Johnston said. You can't make up your mind. You don't know what you are, even.
Let's drop me, said Henry Carpenter. He lit a cigarette.
Why should I? Well, one reason you might is because I go with you on your bloody yacht, and at least half the time I do what you want to do, and that keeps you from paying blackmail to the busboys and the sailors and one thing and another that do know what they are and what you are.
You're in a pretty mood, said Wallace Johnston. You know I never pay blackmail.
No, you're too tight to. You have friends like me instead.
I haven't any other friends like you.
Don't be charming, said Henry. I don't feel up to it tonight. Just go ahead and play Bach and abuse your steward and drink a little too much and go to bed.
What's gotten into you? Said the other, standing up. Why are you getting so damned unpleasant? You're not such a great bargain, you know.
I know, said Henry. I'll be oh so jolly tomorrow. But tonight's a bad night. Didn't you ever notice any difference in nights? I suppose when you're rich enough there isn't any difference.
You talk like a schoolgirl.
Good night, said Henry Carpenter. I'm not a schoolgirl nor a schoolboy. I'm going to bed. Everything will be awfully jolly in the morning.
What did you lose? Is that what makes you so gloomy?
I lost 300. See, I told you that was it.
You always know, don't you?
But look, you lost 300.
I've lost more than that.
How much more?
The jackpot, said Henry Carpenter. The eternal jackpot. I'm playing a machine now that doesn't give jackpots anymore. Only tonight I just happen to think about it. Usually I don't think about it. Now I'm going to bed so I won't bore you.
You don't bore me, but just try not to be rude.
I'm afraid I'm rude and you bore me. Good night. Everything will be fine tomorrow.
You damned rude.
Take it or leave it, said Henry. I've been doing both all my life.
Good night, said Wallace Johnston hopefully. Henry Carpenter did not answer. He was listening to the Bach.
Don't go off to bed like that, Wallace Johnston said. Why be so temperamental?
Drop it.
Why should I? I've seen you come out of it before.
Drop it.
Have a drink and cheer up.
I don't want a drink and it wouldn't cheer me up.
Well, go off to bed then.
I am, said Henry Carpenter.
That was how it was that night on the new Exuma 2, with a crew of 12, Captain Nils Larsen, master, and on board, Wallace Johnston, owner, 38 years old, M.A. Harvard, composer, money from silk mills, unmarried, interdit de séjour in Paris, well known from Algiers to Biskra, and one guest, Henry Carpenter, 36, M.A. Harvard, money now 200 a month in trust fund from his mother, formerly 450 a month until the bank administering the trust fund had exchanged one good security for another good security, for other not-so-good securities, and finally, for an equity in an office building the bank had been saddled with and which paid nothing at all. Long before this reduction in income, it had been said of Henry Carpenter that if he were dropped from a height of 5,500 feet without a parachute, he would land safely with his knees under some rich man's table. But he gave value in good company for his entertainment, and while it was only lately and rarely that he felt or expressed himself as he had tonight, his friends had felt for some time that he was cracking up. If he had not been felt to be cracking up, with that instinct for feeling something wrong with a member of the pack and healthy desire to turn him out, if it is impossible to destroy him, which characterizes the rich, he would not have been reduced to accepting the hospitality of Wallace Johnston. As it was, Wallace Johnston, with his rather special pleasures, was Henry Carpenter's last stand, and he was defending his position better than he knew for his honest courting of an end to their relationship. His subsequent brutality of expression,
and sincere insecurity of tenure intrigued and seduced the other, who might, given Henry Carpenter's age, have easily been bored by a steady compliance. Thus Henry Carpenter postponed his inevitable suicide by a matter of weeks, if not of months. The money, on which it was not worthwhile for him to live, was $170 more a month than the fisherman Albert Tracy had been supporting his family on at the time of his death 3 days before. Aboard the other yachts lying at the finger piers, there were other people with other problems. On one of the largest yachts, a handsome black barkentine-rigged three-master, a 60-year-old grain broker lay awake worrying about the report he had received from his office of the activities of the investigators from the Internal Revenue Bureau. Ordinarily, at this time of night, he would have quieted his worry with Scotch highballs and have reached the state where he felt as tough and regardless of consequences as any of the old brothers of the coast with whom, in character and standards of conduct, he had truly much in common. But his doctor had forbidden him all liquor for a month, for 3 months, really. That is, they had said it would kill him in a year if he did not give up alcohol for at least 3 months. So he was going to lay off it for a month. And now he worried about the call he had received from the Bureau before he left town, asking him exactly where he was going and whether he planned to leave the United States coastal waters. He lay now, in his pajamas, on his wide bed, two pillows under his head, the reading light on, but he could not keep his mind on the book, which was an account of a trip to Galapagos. In the old days, he had never brought them to this bed. He'd had them in their cabins, and he came to this bed afterwards. This was his own stateroom, as private to him as his office. He never wanted a woman in his room. When he wanted one, he went to hers, and when he was through, he was through. And now that he was through for good, his brain had the same clear coldness always that had in the old days been an after effect. And he lay now, with no kindly blurring, denied all that chemical courage that had soothed his mind and warmed his heart for so many years, and wondered what the department had, what they had found, and what they would twist, what they would accept as normal, and what they would insist was evasion. And he was not afraid of them, but only hated them and the power they would use so insolently that all his own hard, small, tough, and lasting insolence, the one permanent thing he had gained and that was truly valid, would be drilled through, and if he were ever made afraid, shattered. He did not think in any abstractions, but in deals, in sales, in transfers, and in gifts. He thought in shares, in bales, in thousands of bushels, in options, holding companies, trusts, and subsidiary corporations. As he went over it, he knew they had plenty, enough so he would have no peace for years. If they would not compromise, it would be very bad. In the old days, he would not have worried. But the fighting part of him was tired now, along with the other part, and he was alone in all of this now, and he lay on the big, wide, old bed and could neither read nor sleep. His wife had divorced him 10 years before, after 20 years of keeping up appearances, and he had never missed her, nor had he ever loved her. He had started with her money, and she had borne him 2 male children, both of whom, like their mother, were fools. He had treated her well until the money he had made was double her original capital, and then he could afford to take no notice of her. After his money had reached that point, he had never been annoyed by her sick headaches, by her complaints, or by her plans. He had ignored them. He had been admirably endowed for a speculative career because he had possessed extraordinary sexual vitality which gave him the confidence to gamble well. Common sense, an excellent mathematical brain, a permanent but controlled skepticism, a skepticism which was as sensitive to impending disaster as an accurate aneroid barometer to atmospheric pressure, and a valid time sense that kept him from trying to hit tops or bottoms. These, coupled with a lack of morals, an ability to make people like him without ever liking or trusting them in return, while at the same time convincing them warmly and heartily of his friendship, not a disinterested friendship, but a friendship so interested in their success that it automatically made them accomplices, and an incapacity for either remorse or pity,
had carried him to where he was now. And where he was now was lying in a pair of striped silk pajamas that covered his shrunken old man's chest, his bloated little belly, his now useless and disproportionately large equipment that had once been his pride, and his small, flabby legs, lying on a bed unable to sleep because he finally had remorse. His remorse was to think if only he had not been quite so smart 5 years ago. He could have paid the taxes then without any juggling, and if he had only done so, he would be all right now. So he lay thinking of that, and finally he slept. But because remorse had once found the crack and begun to seep in, he did not know he slept, because his brain kept on as it had while he was awake. So there would be no rest, and at his age, it would not take so long for that to get him. He used to say that only suckers worried, and he would keep from worrying now until he could not sleep. He might keep from it until he slept, but then it would come in, and since he was this old, its task was easy. He would not need to worry about what he had done to other people, nor what had happened to them due to him, nor how they'd ended. Who'd moved from houses on the Lakeshore Drive to taking boarders out in Austin? Whose debutante daughters now were dentist's assistants when they had a job? Who ended up a night watchman at 63 after that last corner? Who shot himself early one morning before breakfast, and which one of his children found him, and what the mess looked like? Who now rode on the L to work when there was work from Berwyn, trying to sell, first bonds, then motor cars, then house-to-housing, novelties and specialties. "We don't want no peddlers, get out of here," the door slammed in his face, until he varied the leaning drop his father made from 42 floors up, with no rush of plumes as when an eagle falls, to a step forward onto the third rail in front of the Aurora Elgin train, his overcoat pocket full of unsalable combination egg beaters and fruit juice extractors. "Just let me demonstrate it, madame. You attach it here, screw down on this little gadget here. Now watch." "No, I don't want it." "Just try one." "I don't want it. Get out." So he got out onto the sidewalk with the frame houses, the naked yards, and the bare catalpa trees where no one wanted it or anything else that led down to the Aurora Elgin tracks. Some made the long drop from the apartment or the office window. Some took it quietly in two-car garages with the motor running. Some used the native tradition of the Colt or Smith and Wesson, those well-constructed implements that end insomnia, terminate remorse, cure cancer, avoid bankruptcy, and blast an exit from intolerable positions by the pressure of a finger, those admirable American instruments so easily carried, so sure of effect, so well designed to end the American dream when it becomes a nightmare. Their only drawback, the mess they leave for relatives to clean up. The men he broke made all these various exits, but that never worried him. Somebody had to lose, and only suckers worried. No, he would not have to think of them, nor of the byproducts of successful speculation. You win, somebody's got to lose, and only suckers worry. It would be enough for him to think about how much it would be better if he had not been quite so smart 5 years ago, and in a little while at his age, the wish to change what can no longer be undone will open up the gap that will let worry in. Only suckers worry. But he can knock the worry if he takes a scotch and soda. The hell with what the doctor said. So he rings for one, and the steward comes sleepily, and as he drinks it, the speculator is not a sucker now, except for death. While on the next yacht beyond, a pleasant, dull, and upright family are asleep, the father's conscience is good, and he sleeps soundly on his side, a clipper ship running before a blow framed above his head, the reading light on, a book dropped beside the bed. The mother sleeps well and dreams about her garden. She is 50. But is a handsome, wholesome, well-kept woman who looks attractive as she sleeps. The daughter dreams about her fiancé, who comes tomorrow on the plane, and she stirs in her sleep and laughs at something in the dream, and, without waking, raises her knees almost against her chin, curled up like a cat, with curly blonde hair and her smooth-skinned pretty face. Asleep she looks as her mother did when she was a girl. They are a happy family, and all love each other. The father is a man of civic pride and many good works, who opposed prohibition, is not bigoted, and is generous, sympathetic, understanding, and almost never irritable. The crew of the yacht are well paid, well fed, and have good quarters. They all think highly of the owner and like his wife and daughter. The fiancé is a skull and bones man, voted most likely to succeed, voted most popular, who still thinks more of others than of himself, and would be too good for anyone except a lovely girl like Frances. He is probably a little too good for Frances, too, but it will be years before Frances realizes this, perhaps, and she may never realize it with luck. The type of man who is tapped for bones is rarely also tapped for bed, but with a lovely girl like Frances, intention counts as much as performance. So anyhow, they all sleep well. And where did the money come from that they're all so happy with and use so well and gracefully? The money came from selling something everybody uses by the millions of bottles, which cost 3 cents a quart to make, for a dollar a bottle in the large pint size, 50 cents in the medium, and a quarter in the small. But it's more economical to buy the large, and if you make $10 a week, the cost is just the same to you as though you were a millionaire and the product's really good. It does just what it says it will, and more besides. Grateful users from all over the world keep writing in discovering new uses, and old users are as loyal to it as Harold Tompkins, the fiancé, is to Skull and Bones, or Stanley Baldwin is to Harrow. There are no suicides when money's made that way, and everyone sleeps soundly on the yacht Alzira 3, Master John Jacobson, crew of 14, owner and family aboard. At Pier 4, there's a 34-foot yawl-rigged yacht with two of the 324 Estonians who are sailing around in different parts of the world, in boats between 28 and 36 feet long and sending back articles to the Estonian newspapers. These articles are very popular in Estonia and bring their authors between a dollar and $1.30 a column. They take the place occupied by the baseball or football news in American newspapers and are run under the heading of Sagas of Our Intrepid Voyagers. No well-run yacht basin in southern waters is complete without at least two sunburned, salt-bleached-headed Estonians who are waiting for a check from their last article. When it comes, they will sail to another yacht basin and write another saga. They are very happy, too, almost as happy as the people on the Alzira 3. It's great to be an intrepid voyager. On the Eridia 4, a professional son-in-law of the very rich and his mistress, named Dorothy, the wife of that highly paid Hollywood director John Hollis, whose brain is in the process of outlasting his liver so that he will end up calling himself a communist to save his soul, his other organs being too corroded to attempt to save them, are asleep. The son-in-law, big-framed, good-looking in a poster way, lies on his back snoring. But Dorothy Hollis, the director's wife, is awake, and she puts on a dressing gown, and going out onto the deck, looks across the dark water of the yacht basin to the line the breakwater makes. It is cool on the deck, and the wind blows her hair, and she smooths it back from her tanned forehead, and pulling the robe tighter around her, her nipples rising in the cold, notices the lights of a boat coming along the outside of the breakwater. She watches them moving steadily and rapidly along, and then at the entrance to the basin the boat's searchlight is switched on, and comes across the water in a sweep that blinds her as it passes, picking up the Coast Guard pier where it lit up the group of men waiting there, and the shining black of the new ambulance from the funeral home, which also doubles at funerals as a hearse. I suppose it would be better to take some luminol, Dorothy thought. I must get some sleep. Poor Eddie's tight as a tick. It means so much to him, and he's so nice, but he gets so tight he goes right off to sleep. He's so sweet. Of course, if I married him, he'd be off with someone else, I suppose. He is sweet, though. Poor darling, he's so tight. I hope he won't feel miserable in the morning. I must go and set this wave and get some sleep. It looks like the devil.
I do want to look lovely for him. He is sweet. I wish I'd brought a maid. I couldn't, though. Not even Bates. I wonder how poor John is. Oh, he's sweet, too. I hope he's better. His poor liver. I wish I were there to look after him. I might go and get some sleep so I won't look a fright tomorrow. Eddie is sweet. So's John and his poor liver. Oh, his poor liver. Eddie is sweet. I wish he hadn't gotten so tight. He's so big and jolly and marvelous and all. Perhaps he won't get so tight tomorrow. She went below and found her way to her cabin, and sitting before the mirror commenced brushing her hair 100 strokes. She smiled at herself in the mirror as the long bristled brush swept through her lovely hair. Eddie is sweet. Yes, he is. I wish he hadn't gotten so tight. Men all have something that way. Look at John's liver. Of course you can't look at it. It must look dreadful, really. I'm glad you can't see it. Nothing about a man's really ugly, though. It's funny how they think it is, though. I suppose a liver, though. Or kidneys. Kidneys en bullshit. How many kidneys are there? There's 2 of nearly everything except stomach and heart. And brain, of course. There. That's 100 strokes. I love to brush my hair. It's almost the only thing you do that's good for you, that's fun. I mean, by yourself. Oh, Eddie is sweet. Suppose I just went in there. No, he's too tight. Poor boy. I'll take the luminol. She looked at herself in the mirror. She was extraordinarily pretty with a small, very fine figure. Oh, I'll do, she thought. Some of it isn't as good as some of the rest of it, but I'll do for a while yet. You do have to have sleep, though. I'd love to sleep. I wish I could get just 1 good, natural, real sleep, the way we slept when we were kids. I suppose that's the thing about growing up and marrying and having children and then drinking too much and then doing all the things you shouldn't. If you could sleep well, I don't think any of it would be bad for you. Except drinking too much, I suppose. Poor John and his liver and Eddie. Eddie is darling, anyway. He is cute. I'd better take the luminol. She made a face at herself in the glass. You'd better take the luminol, she said in a whisper. She took the luminol with a glass of water from the chromium-plated thermos carafe that was on the locker by the bed. It makes you nervous, she thought, but you have to sleep. I wonder how Eddie would be if we were married. He would be running around with someone younger, I suppose. I suppose they can't help the way they're built any more than we can. I just want a lot of it, and I feel so fine. And being someone else or someone new doesn't really mean a thing. It's just it itself, and you would love them always if they gave it to you. The same one, I mean. But they aren't built that way. They want someone new or someone younger or someone that they shouldn't have or someone that looks like someone else. Or if you're dark, they want a blonde. Or if you're blonde, they go for a redhead. Or if you're a redhead, then it's something else. A Jewish girl, I guess. And if they've had really enough, they want Chinese or lesbians or goodness knows what. I don't know. Or they just get tired, I suppose. You can't blame them if that's the way they are. And I can't help John's liver either. Or that he's drunk so much he isn't any good. He was good. He was marvelous. He was. He really was. And Eddie is. But now he's tight. I suppose I'll end up a bitch. Maybe I'm one now. I suppose you never know when you get to be one. Only her best friends would tell her. You don't read it in Mr. Winchell. That would be a good new thing for him to announce. Bitchhood. Mrs. John Hollis canine into town from the coast. Better than babies. More common, I guess. But women have a bad time, really. The better you treat a man, and the more you show him you love him, the quicker he gets tired of you.
I suppose the good ones are made to have a lot of wives, but it's awfully wearing trying to be a lot of wives yourself, and then someone simple takes him when he's tired of that. I suppose we all end up as bitches, but whose fault is it? The bitches have the most fun, but you have to be awfully stupid, really.